I took off my apron and I said, I'm worth more than this.
Hey, take a slow morning. Go surf.
Design is a superpower.
He's already in there. He's why I'm so fired up right now.
I do too. That dude doesn't need an advocate. He's doing just fine on his own, man.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I am Jess Brown, one of your hosts. And I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for joining us on this first episode. We're going to dive into a little bit about our beliefs and what makes us who we are. So I'm really excited to share that with you. And I won't waste any more of your time. Here's episode one.
Today I was thinking that we could talk a little bit about, you know, our beliefs. You know,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Beliefs not being just, you know, like beliefs kind of a hotbed word, but, you know, beliefs kind of are the, what I think are like the pillar of why you act and do the way that you do. And I think I can learn a lot about people or even myself and the things that I do, when I kind of fundamentally uncover like what I believe in, just as a human being.
Yeah. Why are your beliefs so important that, for instance, when I used to work a very manual labor job, my belief structure had nothing to do with that. I just went in there, did the work, left.
Oh yeah. No, I think most of my beliefs came from when I worked really, really crappy manual jobs, you know? And I think, my beliefs were formed in kind of the pit fires of adversity and those sleepless nights when I was like, how am I going to pay the bills? What am I doing with my life? I'm not going to call them summits of anxiety because they're more like pits of anxiety. And I can remember like two or three of them in my life and thinking, how do I get out of this place? I never want to be here again, but now, you know, it's the age old sentiment where those are the valuable times, you know, like those are the refining moments. And mostly not necessarily because I had people in my life that showed me what good look like as far as kind of treating me in a humanitarian way and kind of understanding and having empathy for me, but really seeing like what not to do in those moments. Because when you're down and out and you don't have, you know, when you're not trending on anything and people aren't looking at you as an example, you know, the judgment comes out of the woodwork. You know what I'm saying? Like they're not, it's not like people are like admiring you at all. And the irony of all of that is that in my deepest pit of despair versus who I am now, there's not a lot of difference. Like I'm kind of the same person. I've gone through a lot of changes and growth. But fundamentally, like what I believed was really similar. And I don't know.
How did you find that for yourself? I think I fall into this category of strong opinions, but loosely held. Like I still fundamentally believe that I can be convinced out of my stance pretty quickly.
Oh, and that's the difference of like beliefs. I like beliefs. I don't think are something that you can be convinced otherwise. Like for instance, one of my beliefs is that everybody should be treated like a human being, you know, and just because say for instance, you're an administrative assistant, or your vice president of product, and you can point verifiably to all the revenue that you drive for the company, where an administrative assistant is, you know, navigating calendars and taking phone calls and getting coffee and lunch and kind of making life really, really good. One would argue that, you know, one person is better than the other. And I have a fundamental belief that that's not true. And so like no amount of persuasion could pull me off of that belief. And I see it all the time. And it's what I think differentiates me, from a lot of people that I run into, especially as I move up the corporate ladder. I learned that a lot of people don't share that belief. They might say it, but when I see it in action, it doesn't really ring through as something that they believe in.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. I saw something the other day, they were talking about the fundamental belief of treating people as just humans. Everybody's a human, treat them kindly and with respect. And her father, I believe, was a plumber. She's like, when she would go on some of those calls with him, and then some people would treat him like a servant, like, go do your work, I don't want to talk to you, whatever. And other people would like check in, offer drinks, some food, you know, and just, it's a fundamental difference. And I think,
do you want to know where the lightning rod of where it hit for me?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was 2008 and, you know, the economy crashed. I was working up in Bend, Oregon as a Finnish carpenter and, you know, building production homes. And I actually really loved my life. It was simple, you know. I worked with my hands. I worked with good people. And then the economy tanked and it was like literally overnight, tons of jobs to negative jobs. To the point where like my boss had employed me, shut his business down and became like a state trooper in Oregon, like doesn't do anything with woodwork anymore. And I was going back to college at that time. And because I realized like I have to do something and there was no jobs opening up. And my wife worked at Starbucks. We lived in a room in Menifee, California, my wife and my two kids, my oldest two, Boston and Josiah. We literally lived in a room in Menifee with no money. And I was taking online classes at Saddleback Community College in Orange County. So, and my wife worked at Starbucks and she was like a shift lead and she became friends with the manager and the manager, she talked the manager into allowing me to work there. And why, you know, why would she need to talk her into allowing me to work there? Cause I'm covered in tattoos. I have tattoos on my hands and my knuckles and my neck. And, visibly I'm a deterrent to most people. Most people are appalled by the way that I look. And I get that. And it's funny because people oftentimes tell me that I deserve it because I did it to myself, you know?
Good Lord. That's a podcast by itself.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's really, if you ever on LinkedIn and somebody posts a comment about like tattoos in the workplace, that's where like the, that's where the comments is like, where you're like, holy crap, like people hate me, you know? And, but like, so she talked the manager into allowing me to work at Starbucks. And the thing that's interesting is at the time, Starbucks had like a very strict no tattoo policy. Like you couldn't have anything visible. And so I made a deal where I would literally wear, you know, a long sleeve shirt, a turtleneck, a scarf that I sewed that would go up high because I had tattoos like underneath my ears. And then I even bought like theater makeup to cover the tattoos that were exposed. And then I had to wear black latex gloves on my hands. And I looked, way scarier in this outfit, especially because we were in Murrieta or Menifee area. And like, it's 114 degrees outside and I'm schlepping Frappuccinos looking like Edward Scissorhands, you know, like it just was, it was really bad. And I was like a week into it doing it. Cause like I was desperate. I needed a job. I needed to do something. And, it was horrible. And here's the best part too, is the point of sale system was a touchpad and the latex gloves like blocked it. So I had to cut fingers. So I had like these like bum gloves on. So it just looked really, it looked all kinds of nasty. And
I was gonna say you in my head right now, you look like the lead singer of AFI. Like it, that's what I see in my head right now.
Yeah. It was weird. And I was like, this is weird. I was embarrassed. Like, and you know, I'm pretty easily embarrassed guy. You know, and so I was on the bar making drinks and I had one person, you know, come to me and say, you know, kindly, like, hey, would you mind having somebody else make my drink? And I was like, sure. You know, and I was like, cool. Second person, probably about an hour later, what's wrong with you? You look like you have a disease. And I was like, you're right. This is really weird. You know, I have to wear this because of the policy of the company, you know? And it was kind of at this moment where I was thinking in my head, like, just because I have like tattoos, does it make me less able to engage with people, look them in the eyes, you know, show them community, show them care, craft a latte, you know, do something special for them? No, like it doesn't inhibit that ability to do it. And then the third person, probably like 30 minutes later, I kid you not, this happened in one day. Third person walked up and said, "You look like you have full-blown AIDS. Please have somebody make somebody else make my drink." And I was like, dude, I don't care. Like, what if I did? Like, and I took off, I took off my apron and I said, "I'm worth more than this," you know? And it's like, I just was like, I'm never, ever going to treat anybody like that, ever, you know? And it's like the commentary and the things that I hear just based on the way that I look, you know, is one end of the spectrum. And then the other side of the spectrum is that I have like 5 kids now. So I get a lot of comments there. And I'm always baffled at like people's ability to comment on things. Like I might think those things, but I very rarely do I like let them out of my mouth.
I think you and I have that in common. I mean, I've got 4, one on the way, but that, man, the comments I've heard in that war, I would never have the ability to say even a fourth of what I've heard from people. It's unbelievable. And it's like nothing about us out in public says that we're struggling or we were idiots to make this happen or whatever. Like, we love our family. We love our kids. We love being with them. Like, where do your opinions even play into this?
I don't know. And it's definitely an indictment on, not necessarily on us, but it's interesting because you wonder, what's systemically, the cause of those things. But anyway, so. When I'm kind of packaging up my beliefs and how I treat people and how I review people, that was a moment where I felt so small, because I was going through one of the hardest times in my life. Like I was renting a room from a lady as a man who was supposed to be providing and caring for his family. And I couldn't make ends meet. And, it was one of the lowest times for me. And I just remember thinking like, gosh, I never want to feel this way. And I never want to ever make anybody feel this way. I never want to kick anybody while they're down.
Yeah. Have you found yourself going out of your way to make a point on that belief of almost like your empathy being higher and just seeing it happen, in front of you in some ways and going out of your way to make sure those people feel at home and mm-hmm. welcome? Is it more than just a belief? Is it a point of action?
I think it's like my core. I mean, right. I think it's something that I'm, it's like you can't really put it on LinkedIn and say, endorse me for community building. But I think it is central to team building. I believe people do better work when they feel protected and cared for. I mean, like what's the buzz terminology now is like mental security or psychological safety. You hear those in all the HR kind of talks and whatnot, but it's something where you need to have, if you have a leader that's like that, I always tell everybody, if you find a leader that has that quality, follow that person. And a lot of people mistake it, right? A lot of people think, oh, if you have that quality, you're just overly nice and you overlook poor work and you don't hold people accountable. But if you did, for me, it's like I'm really hard on my team. But if there's like a balance, because I'm really intentional to acknowledge the wins, but then also very, very intentional to like, discover what the opportunities for enhancement are, and lean into it. What I mean? Like it's not, I think you earn the right to be critical once you have given credit where it's due. Like for instance, right now, at work, currently we just launched a brand new app and, a lot of people on my team, including myself, took a risk on putting it on a new platform called Flutter. And it's relatively new, but we felt like we had the opportunity to do something, fantastic to eliminate 2 dev teams and consolidate it into one. and it's crushing it. Like the numbers are through the roof. Like things are going really great. And I have a leader who gave credit to a group of people that had absolutely nothing to do with it. In fact, if you really were to like be honest, they stood as tripping points throughout the process. And when you have a leader that does that, you lose a lot of safety, you know, a lot of security, because that person doesn't have the eyes to see, you know, what really happened or ask the questions. There's just a lack of care and intentionality. And I think I'm hyper-focused on making sure that my team feels that I see them. Not in like just trite bullshit things like, hey, good job, that was awesome. But hey, no, when you did these four specific things, I see what you did there, you know? So, you know.
Yeah, I just did reviews with my team, and there was a self-review, and then we kind of talked about it. And honestly, most of the people on my team are more like friends than colleagues at this point. But it's like, man, you're being extra hard on yourself. I totally understand it, but you spent way more time on the things that you wish you can improve than touting your wins. But then in that instance, I also realized that's exactly what I do. And it's kind of like an unspoken, like you're saying, you're kind of hard on people in a way, but it's more like you're treating them with the same level of accountability that you have for yourself. Do you think that's something that can be taught to other people, or is that something that purely has to be learned through personal experience?
I don't know. I think there are things that I believe magnify whether you have it or not, you know, where it's like, I was listening to a book the other day, and one of the main characters of the book's wife was talking about money, right? And, you know, just kind of generally kind of just asking a question. Money is like a magnifying glass, right? That if you're a good person, or like you have like, I don't know, stable beliefs, money just magnifies that. Like, you know, but if you're an asshole, money just makes you a bigger asshole. And I think a lot of that has to do even in authority as well. And when you take on more responsibilities and a broader leadership team, it becomes really clear what type of leader you are. And I'm not going to deny the fact that you can get juice out of people through fear tactics, but I fundamentally believe that it's not scalable, right? And laughter and joy and health is, you know, a far more scalable, you know, team dynamic to get more work out of people. And I just don't, I think a lot of times I see people just think that it's like lazy, or not lazy, but, you know, something that is letting people off the hook, you know, where you have, you know, people that stay late in the office are championed, you know, people that burn the midnight oil over the weekend. Right. And, you know, an empathic leader is going to be the one that's like, that's really mismanagement of your time. And I'm actually going to get less out of you if you're working past 10 o'clock than if you went home and got good sleep and came back. And I've experienced that. And I think I learned that through engineering leadership, because just how critical code writing is. And like, as a human gets tired, they make more mistakes. And when you're writing code and you have mistakes and bugs, it bites you way bigger in the end. And so I'd always see, you know, engineering leadership really guard their teams and be very clear and even kind of sandbag what their sprints would look like. And, you know, I learned a lot of that just from building out my teams and making sure that they had that proper space and really holding them accountable to like not, you know, feel like they had to work Herculean hours. Now there's times where, and the good thing about that is like when it's time, you know, where it's like, hey, we have this deadline approaching and we got to get it done in a really short amount of time, they're ready to sprint really hard for you. You know, it's like you've created a team that will, you know, break their backs for you versus, mm-hmm. Oh, again, here we go again.
Yep.
So
I think there's a level of transparency that you have to have in that too, because as long as they know where they're, where you're coming from, and this isn't a mismanagement of your own time, mm-hmm. and that's why we have to do this all-nighter or week of no sleep or whatever it might be, you know, that it's for the better of the entire team, or, you know, to hit that. It's like, well, we're just trying to, I think about with like sports, like this is hell week. Like we're all kicking in right now. We're new or whatever. We got to prove ourselves once, get really back into shape for a second, you know, type of thing. And then, then we have the weekend and we chill and we're good. But, back to something you were saying earlier, I've told a handful of my, the people on my team, like, hey, take a slow morning, go surf.
Yeah.
Or, go to a coffee shop and read a book for a little bit. Like, it's okay to take that moment for yourself today and maybe only work in the office for 6 hours, but I guarantee you those will probably be six of the most productive hours you'll ever have because you came in ready for the day. And I think that's something that really honestly has to be taught too, you know, like taking care of yourself is an art form. It's interesting you pointed to the engineering side of that too, because that's where I learned how to like time box myself or do mini sprints through a day, because I used to sit for hours and code and go and all of a sudden you're ready to hit print and there's this error and you find out that it's something you wrote in the third hour of the 4 hours you never moved from your desk, and there, you know, it's a missing little piece of syntax. And it's done. Where if I had been good to myself and got up and walked around and given myself little breaks here and there, I wouldn't have made that mistake. And then that mistake takes another 2 hours to go back and find. And like you said, it's just a never ending.
Yeah.
Never ending wheel.
I think it all plays into it just becomes a big, I think of it as a garden. You know, team leadership and this type of stuff. And like leading this way is an element of gardening. And it doesn't happen overnight, you know, and a lot of times you're going to have to really humble yourself in the sense that it's a real struggle when you, as a leader, start to feel like I'm not contributing. You know what I'm saying? Like they're like all these people are, you know, because you can't really put a label on what it is to create a team that's efficient and activated, and running in sync and in harmony. Right. And a lot of times outside people will look at like a well-run engine and then go, I just want the engine. I don't need this guy who's overseeing it. And there's a lot of behind the scenes of kind of walking, kind of updating and maintaining that engine as a whole. Like, so for instance, like, you know, you loan out your design team. I do. I loan my design team out to product people and to engineers or business stakeholders to kind of help work through and go through sprints and build deliverables and whatever. And then there's a relationship, I hope, with all of those people that they're working with. But really quickly, that relationship can turn into something that's a bit unhealthy, because that designer that has been loaned out is somebody that produces beneficial artifacts for the other people's success. And so they'll circumnavigate. I don't need to go through Willie. I'm going to go around and I'm going to talk straight to him. And I think that could be, you know, in an area of kind of maintaining health and growth for a design team, it's one of the first steps of kind of decay. And it's because say you have an ambitious designer that wants to grow and, you know, be known, you know, it's like, oh, I don't have to, you know, I'm going to build this up. But a lot of times when you get stuck alone, that is, you kind of get stuck and you're like, holy crap, I'm stuck. So like what my team does is they'll hear it, but they'll always circle back and be like, hey, I'm hearing this. And then we'll together assess, like we'll orchestrate in the background and say, yeah, I think you should totally do that. Or like, what? That's whack. Well, that's coming from left field. Let's pause. That's a distraction. You know, pull me in. And a lot of times there's a lot of dialogue going on behind the scenes with my team you know, when they pull me in, when they don't. And I think a lot of that's predominantly because we have a high level of trust with each other, and they know the value that I bring, and it might not be that I'm pushing pixels,
right?
In that value,
yep.
And that's tough at times, you know.
Yeah,
because you live in...
for you or for your team to not be in the pixels.
I think it's tougher for me. You know. It's because I'm not pushing the pixels, but I'm definitely priming the vision and helping to set the criteria. And I don't know about you, but in design, when you don't have doorknobs to walk through, it's a really daunting zone. Like, it just feels like an insurmountable mountain when you're like, I don't even have a direction. But when you get a direction or you get a vision, like, it goes from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. in the blink of an eye, because you're so engulfed in it. And that's a really cool feeling. So, like, my goal is now, how do I get my team in that zone at a more effective percentage, you know?
Yep. And that's super important, because I think you know this as well as I do. When you're working with people that have been executives for a long time, they forget the vision part of it. It becomes very much purely KPI driven, and it's like, let's try anything, we got to get 0.5% and we don't care how, versus bringing it all back, talking, communicating well, creating an actual vision and a hope for a real outcome. I mean, I know you honestly just did that with the launch of your new app, but I mean, that stuff, in my opinion, is not any different than design, because like a design project is taking everybody's different inputs, from photos to copy to, you know, whatever, and trying to make it one coherent message that people can understand very, very quickly. So to me, it feels like the same work in a way. I just don't have to be behind a computer anymore to do it.
I think one of the things that I'm always pushing, not just my team, but other people around, is that design is a superpower. And the sooner you can synthesize around a statement or an idea or a concept, who cares where it comes from? Like, it could come from, you know, just somebody who's running a certain aspect of the business or the company that you're working for. It could come from, you know, an engineer, it could come from anything. But what the designers have the ability to do is take a statement and visualize it, and then surround a group of people around that visualization to then have effective conversations. So for instance, like, this is one of my favorite examples, and I don't know, it could be a terrible one, but if I say to you and three other people, I want you to picture a mountain. You and three other people are going to picture four different mountains. One will have like flowers, one will have trees, one will be snow-capped, one will be rocky, you know, but they're all mountains. And I think what happens is that we spend way too much time in the design process talking, and developing a visualization in our own individual heads of what it's going to be. And then when the designer finally relinquishes visuals, oftentimes there's a lot of people that are disappointed in it. Oftentimes it just happens. And then that disappointment is really hard for designers. So like my thought is like, activate soon, like first meeting, first kickoff, get wireframes, get something to circle around so that you can look at it. Even if everybody is just like, I hate this, that's fantastic. Why? Like, I want to understand the criteria of your hatred for this, you know, because a lot of times it uncovers, you know, business requirements or back-end development requirements that didn't get surfaced up, because there's just a seller of information, and visuals have a power to draw things out far more than language, which is like super important. And it's like, oftentimes we can step on people's toes because we have moved too far forward. But for me, it's like, no, this is open-handed. We're holding this, look at it. You know, are we going the right direction, or do we need to pivot massively? Both are acceptable answers. Does that make sense? It's our way of being intentional.
Yeah. How do you manage that in the world of design by committee in a way where, you know, it doesn't feel like everything was a compromise to get it out there, you know, where it's something that you can still be proud of as an individual and as a corporation.
No, that's great. I honestly, I believe that this actually destroys design by committee, and this kind of creates, you know, more opportunities to kind of set very clear criteria. And so I'm always trying to get people to assess and judge based on criteria requirements, and kind of move them away from style, because like you and I both know that there's like 40 to 100 different ways to approach design, and it go from one creative director, one design director to the next. And like one could love it, the other one could have a visceral reaction. And it is like one of the most complicated, you know, it's not black and white, but criteria and requirements are. And so as a designer, I want my team to be able to like point to like, here's how I met this criteria. Here's how I met this criteria. And the conversation then becomes, I believe that you met that criteria 100%. Or I see how you're trying to meet this criteria or this requirement, but it's not hitting it. Have you thought of this, or this? And I feel like those are really productive conversations. Getting away from, nah, it's just not, I'm not a fan of that, you know, but more towards the, like a committee is like they're, you get the impression in my brain, I don't know about you, but I visualize a group of people that are sitting with stern faces and their hands are on their chin and they're just judging you. Right. That's what I think of when I think of committee.
Yep.
But when I think
it's that and very vague rounds of feedback of, I'm not feeling it.
Like yeah.
That as a piece of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Mean it's like, well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
what does that even mean? That's subjective.
So I hear that. And what I want to do is kind of own the narrative. Right. And so I want to turn that committee into a cohort of builders, like help me build this and make it better. Own this with me. We are one aspect of it, but I need all of these people to be a part of it. And, you know, in a perfect world, you're able to kind of select that committee, you know, that mind share. And, you know, I think that's key. And I think I've been able to move that narrative in the right direction, through various projects. And it's kind of, I think sometimes it's just about kind of breaking things into quadrants and talking about the first like meetings with designers are just aligning on criteria. I'm not going to, you know, it's like, just here it is the things that we're going to judge against, you know? Like if you're in a beauty pageant and the criteria is, you know, how well do you sing? And then you fail to get past the next level because you couldn't do a backflip. The contestants are going to be like, wait, what? That wasn't one of the criteria. And that's kind of what happens a lot in design, you know, for us. It's like, and, you know, I'm willing to kind of block any movement forward until I get a very strong inclination that the criteria is clear for my team. And I, you know, that's one of the areas that I'm willing to die on, you know, die over, you know, well,
yeah.
Die. I'm going to die over design, but
metaphorical,
you know what I mean? Yeah.
Like the hill to die upon. Yeah. And I think that goes back to what you're saying with like a vision, like when you have the vision, 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. goes by in a split second.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's worth putting that work up front to make sure that you're all going in the same direction. I mean, there's an analogy that somebody was talking about. It's like, you know, it's everybody in their own individual like boats all headed out, and eventually you'll all get there. But if you all had gotten into just one boat and rowed together, you would have gotten there so much faster and actually at the same location together too. Because some of you might veer off, and I don't know if that's the case. I've always meant to ask you this about paddling. Like, I would imagine if that boat in front of you isn't guiding you a little bit on where you need to go, there's a good chance that you don't wind up in Manhattan Beach. You actually show up in San Onofre or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really dependent on that is a very clear, I think, analogy of criteria. It's like there's a lead boat that is heading towards the right direction on a straight line. And I know if I stay in vision of that boat, I'm going to be okay. And like, I don't feel like that's too much to ask, you know, and the criteria could be like, look, we need to increase, you know, conversion by, you know, 0.5%. And if that's the only criteria you get, you know, I'm not super concerned. Like I'm not going to put a lot of emphasis on how you do it. I want to be judged on what we did. And, but if there is other, like you need to insert that kind of criteria into the mix earlier in the conversation. And I think when that happens, you're right. It's like people feel cumulatively a part of it. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions of designers are that we're prima donnas, that, you know, we, you know, like, ah, oh, they just want things their way. And it's like, I think you can get out ahead of that if you set very clear expectations and you kind of get designers into the methodology of like, this isn't about winning a friggin' award. This is about driving business. And I think a lot of designers do sit in that camp of like, you know, they want elegance first and then work towards, you know, business driving function. And I, you know, oftentimes I'm trying to rearrange my team's mindset to like function business like this. We got to justify our existence for a job. We're not just here to make things look cool and have people go, oh, wow, that's cool, you know, but it has to drive revenue, right? Like Ardeo looked really cool. I thought it was rad. I thought it was the best design platform for, you know, for digital music around, and it doesn't exist.
Right.
So I don't, yeah. You know, I think Craigslist does not look cool, but it remains the number one place to go if you have to sell something really fast to get money for tacos, you know, and it hasn't changed. It is what it is. So I love those examples. And I think when you talk like that, you have the power to kind of gather influence with business people. It's like, hey, I'm driving the same thing as you are. I just have a different, superpower.
Right, and, absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, back to where we were at with the belief side of this. And I think I've heard a handful of those come into just even this part of the conversation. But like you said, your first one is treat people like people. Where do you go from there? Where else are your beliefs tied into this methodology of how you operate and run as an individual and
yeah,
as a leader and a father and all of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, treating people like people, a facet of that is being willing to guard your team against the stuff that's kind of crap, you know?
Yeah.
And for me in my role currently is that I want my product designers doing product design things, because that's where they get the most. Like if I were a product designer, that's what I would want my boss to do, is like just creating a place where I could, you know, build effectively and ship things. And working in the company that I work in, there's all kinds of needs for keynote decks, presentations. And so a lot of times I shoulder that, you know, I joke with my friends, I'm like, I'm a professional deck maker. And there's a couple of valuable things in doing that, is that, you have the power to communicate the value of what you're doing. But getting your team stuck in that rut is you can communicate all you want, but if you're not doing the work, you're going to run out of runway. And you know what I'm saying? And it's like, I always, in order for me to be successful, it's like, I have got to have a team that is like working, that is making, that I can point to a build and say, we increased by this percent. We decreased time spent on finding a reservation by this percent. Like I have got to point at those things, because those are like kind of my safety foundation, whether they like me or not. Willie's team is driving results. And in order to do that, I have to take on a lot of stuff that my team, you know, would get distracted by. And I think when you do that, you build a lot of rapport. And so you build a sentiment that like Willie would never ask me something that he himself would not do. And I learned that I was in the Coast Guard for a little bit. And I you can go in straight out of high school with no college degree and you can work your way up to, I think, like a master chief, senior master chief. I don't know, some sort of, that's the highest you can get without being an officer. So that's one path you can take. And that's like 20, 30 years of grit and determination to get to that point. Or you could go into the Coast Guard Academy or college and graduate and then apply for officer candidate school. And you can enter in the Coast Guard as an ensign, which is theoretically outranks anybody who's on the enlisted class. But one thing I saw is that a kid fresh out of college that had the higher rank would ask people to do something, and the effectiveness of that person's ask was really, really bad. Like, people were just like, cool, bro, we'll do it. But if the Master Chief asked you to do something, people snapped like nobody's business. And that's where I really learned the value of, you know, because they know this Master Chief has cleaned way more toilets, done way more dishes, seen way more garbage than I've ever seen, and has my back. And so there's a relatability influence versus power. And I think that's a big belief of mine, is like influence over power is super important to me. And I do for sure have gotten flack for that. It has stifled my upward move. I've had bosses say like, you need to stop that. You need to worry about the company more. You need to worry about your bosses more. And my belief is, if I worry about my team, they will produce good results. And then that will ladder up to the value of the company. And it's, I think it's common sense, but I you know, the further along I get,
I'm starting to think it isn't anymore.
yeah.
It's interesting, because I mean, I think both of us kind of grew up, you know, with church and things too. And there's, when you're in any form of leadership, on that side, they always say, lead by serving. Like that was one thing that was just always like ingrained in my head. Like, if you're not willing to go do the grossest work, you know, then you have no right to ask anybody else to do it. Like, ask them to come help you do something versus tell them to go do that thing. And that, I'm curious about, you know, I like the way you phrase it better than that, because it's a little less manipulative. But I see it all the time with like my kids. Like, if I want to teach them how to clean a bathroom, I will go in there and I will, instead of just shouting at them, like, scrub there or wipe that off or sweep over there, it's like, all right, I'm going to show you how to do it. I'm going to do it with you. And then you show me that you understand how that works. And then at some point in time, they just know how to do it. And with some of our kids, at least, they'll go out of their way to just do it anyways, because they're like, we appreciate you. We're going to go clean up real quick because we can see that you don't have time to do that for us right now. You know, and I see that in the same respect, you know, going back into a team world mm-hmm. too. Like,
it's super connected. I think. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, you know, I have a 14-year-old, you know, and he's like, on paper, statistically, should be running amok, you know, and he's one of the sweetest, most considerate, kindest human beings ever. And and like, it didn't happen on accident. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't like we were just like, you know, wound him up and we're like, okay, go be a kid. There's so much investment and time laid into the fact that my son will walk up to his coach every day after practice and say, hey, thanks, Geza, appreciate you. And like, and then I'll get feedback like, I don't know what it is about your kids, but they are so different. And, you know, it's like there's a lot of shortcuts that my wife and I choose not to take. And it costs us financially. It costs us time wise. But the investment in it is far more fruitful than the lack of investment. And I don't know. I judge people by their kids. I judge people by their teams. You know, when I'm in the workplace, I'm like, man, their team looks miserable, right? And everywhere I've been, I always get people from other teams emailing me on the side, like, hey, do you have any openings on your team? I have people sending me their portfolio from other creative departments. I mean, it happened at Starbucks. It happened at Thrive Market. I literally at Thrive Market had people go to the CEO and say, how can you make Willie my boss? Right. And it wasn't because I led through authority and power. It was because of, I think, the beliefs that we have in, you know, who we are. And it's hard. It's not like they come easy. Right. And I got an example, right, of something that I believe in that didn't come easy. So we've been working on unclustering this ability to for guests to come to the hotel and check in seamlessly via digital and not have to stay in an hour and a half line. And it's been really tough. And the team did a really great job of kind of getting to a good solution. And it was time to share it with the high up mucky mucks, you know? I call them the bankers because they all look like bankers in their suits. Yep.
You know? They're creepy suits.
I feel like
very thin
tie. I feel like a turd in a punch bowl. You know what I mean? Where I'm like, what am I? I was, every time I'm around him, I want to take a selfie just to prove to people that, like, I do stuff, you know? And I look around and I see like a bunch of people from my department. There's like eight of us in there. And it's one presentation. And I looked around and I was like, I don't need to be here for this. Like, I have so much to do. Like, I have better use of my time. And so I left. It was hard because it was a lot of my team's work and my team's thinking. And the pressure was like, I got to get up there. I got to share it. I got to garnish. I got to gather credit for that. And I was walking out, one of my colleagues who's, you know, he's VP also. And I was a mistake, Willie. You shouldn't have done that. You know, they're going to take the credit. And I looked at him and I said, you know, bro, it's always going to be my belief that you should sit at the end of the table and you let people move you up. The person that goes and sits at the right hand will always get shoved back. And I would rather not get any credit than be the guy that is viewed as the person that always is trying to pony up to the leaders. And even the way when you're in a new meeting or you're meeting new people, there's an agency involved and there's like the introductions and you see the people like, I am the chief Maximus senior highly, you know, like they just like bloviate their title. And my response is always like, I work on the design team. You know, I don't really care if you know if I'm a leader or not, but like my team does. And that's all that matters. And the irony of that, even like circling back to that convo is the, you know, our boss's boss, the guy that was like kind of seeing it over, he texted me like at 10:30 that night. He was like, hey, the work you did with your team was rad. Saw your presentation. Like he knew. Mm-hmm. Like, he knows what our work is. You know, it's like, I don't have to like, you know, schedule parades for myself. And yeah, it's probably cost me some promotions or some finances, but like, I would rather that than it cost me respect for my team. Or myself, yeah, for that matter, you know?
Absolutely. Well, I was going to say, too, that I think that takes a level of confidence in yourself. Like, you aren't defined by how other people view you. Like, you know your worth to the company. You know your team's worth to the company. And you don't have to bullshit.
Yeah, but it's also...
put that value there.
But I would be lying if I said it was really easy. Because it was hard.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, God damn, am I doing the right thing here? Like, should I be tooting my own horn? Because people will say that, like, if you don't toot your horn, nobody else will. And I get it. You know, you got to be confident with certain things that you're doing. But those moments of intentionality show up. And I think whether I was stocking shelves at a retail establishment or working for a Fortune 500 company, there is opportunities to fall into that trap in both places. You know what I'm saying? Like, you should have stayed around to show your manager that you restocked the shampoo aisle in such a perfect way. or just let your work speak for itself and move on. And it's the same type of stuff that I'm instilling in my sons, where it's like, your metrics of growth come from when your dad's not watching you, when your mom's not watching you. Because we hear, we're not stupid. But like, that's when I know you're maturing and growing. And gosh, man, it's a constant battle. And you can just see the natural inclinations to Lord of the Fly. I have five kids sitting in one house. It's like you see just the tendencies to like, you know, destroy each other and, you know, say stupid stuff like, I'm not my brother's keeper. And, you know, and we aspire to something different than that. And I think that's where it transcends no matter what job you're in. And there's like hope in that, you know? So, cause you don't, if you spend your time investing and finding value in accolades, barf, dude, like nothing good comes right from it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Really excited to share the next episode with you. Until then, enjoy your week, and we'll see you soon.